Hello, all of you out there in Radioland. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, hope your computer stays locked on our website, kptz.org. The website's more than a way to listen to today's show. For example, you can find the biographies of all our hosts and DJs. You can look up calendar listings to see what's happening around town. You can even sample some of our earlier shows. In fact, much of the original programming on KPTZ is currently available as podcasts. You know, double your listening pleasure. Listen to today's show as well as some earlier ones. I'm Marianne McNellis. The show's called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around the area? Who was that guy marching briskly along San Juan the other morning? He sported what is politely called male pattern baldness, which is not all that unusual around here. What distinguished him was the fact that what hair he had was bright green. Is today St. Patrick's Day? And speaking of interesting strangers, who was that woman bent over her garden in the pouring rain? That's an early bird. And who are the pool players competing virtually every day at the American Legion, the Senior Center, Sirens, and the Roadhouse? Do they all get together in some grand tournament? If so, when and where? Jefferson County is full of all sorts of fascinating characters. This show, Our Town, tries to profile some of the singular personalities who live here, but the show's only a half hour long, which is definitely not long enough to do justice to some of our fellow citizens. So consider it a synopsis. We try to get our guests to talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up on the western edge of the continent, able to look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, right at Vancouver Island, Canada. Over time, we'll be talking with firemen and foodies, bus drivers and baristas, the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. We try to find out what makes them tick and what they think about living in beautiful Jefferson County amid the deer, the otter, and even the magnificent soaring eagles. Today, my guest is Holly Mayshark, who's the general manager for Quimper Mercantile. Most of our listeners know that the Merc, as people call it, is actually a community-owned store with some 900 shareholders who are actually the owners of the store. But before we get around to discussing that, let's hear a bit about the woman who's in charge of the operation. So, Holly, let's start at the beginning. Are you a local girl, born and bred on the Olympic Peninsula?
No, definitely not.
Okay, where'd you come from?
Well, East Coast is the simple answer. Born in New Jersey, high school in Michigan, college, and a bit thereafter, just in New England area.
Okay, and what'd your folks do?
My father worked for Bethlehem Steel Company, originally in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and then was transferred to New York City, where I lived in New Jersey, and he commuted to New York. And then eventually he got a job with the company doing a little bit more interesting things and not the two-hour commute that he used to have in outside of Detroit, Michigan. So I went to high school there. And then my mother was an early childhood educator, taught at the time they called it nursery school mm-hmm. in New Jersey, and then carried on doing some of that in Michigan, and also was a big supporter of the Unitarian Universalist Church, started a fellowship in New Hampshire and was very active in her community.
Hmm. Well, I think the other day you mentioned to me that your dad was actually a World War II veteran and the recipient of a Purple Heart.
Yes, he definitely was. That probably shaped his life more than he let on. But yes, he was in Northern Africa, wounded in the war. Everybody in his tank below him perished, and he survived. Wow. Almost lost his leg. Many operations later was able to save it, but wow, it definitely imprinted his life.
I would think so. So are you an only child?
No, I'm one of five, actually. I'm four out of five.
Four out of five.
Two girls, three boys.
Okay. And you went to high school in Michigan, right?
Yes, a suburb of Detroit.
Were you very focused as a teenager and knew what you wanted to do?
No, I was focused on having fun, pretty much. And
yeah,
like many teenagers, I definitely did not have a focus on what I wanted to be when I grew up.
Did you have it planned out that you were going to go to college?
Yeah, that was the plan, and I did go to college. They supported me in going to college, my folks.
That's good. Did you go straight through or did you drop out? What happened?
Pretty much nothing was straight in my life.
Okay.
I went to one college for 2 or 3 years, transferred to another college in New England. Ended up, when I moved to the West Coast, studied at a couple other colleges and community colleges and studied many different things.
What were some of the different things you studied?
Spent a lot of time in the art world studying art. I went to a ceramic school south of Rochester, New York for a while, studied ceramics and art. Oh, I studied design, construction, early childhood education, landscape architecture, a little everything.
Did you get jobs in any of those fields?
I would say selling my ceramics and paintings at Pike Place Market early on when people could get a little booth for cheap. I did a lot of work in landscaping for a while, which led me to the next big piece of my work life, which was my flower shop, Holly's Flowers, that I started in 1981.
We missed a piece, though. How did a good Midwestern girl like you end up in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, that all happened because my college friend had moved from the East Coast to Preston, which is outside of Issaquah, and I came out to visit her and basically got stuck.
Got stuck, or did you like it?
A little of everything. Okay. I kind of wanted to move back to New England, but it just didn't work out that way.
Uh-huh. Okay. Did you stay in Issaquah area before you came to Port Townsend? It wasn't immediate, was it?
Right. It wasn't immediate. I was in the Issaquah and then Carnation, Duval, Maltby area for 6 years or so before my then husband, we ended up taking a whole nother year out of the country, then moving to Port Townsend in 1977.
You're just telling me an intriguing thing. You took a year out of the country. What did you do?
That wasn't a straight line either, of course.
What is, right?
Right. We had a friend whose brother had a Norwegian inter-island freighter down in the West Indies, St. Lucia area, and he needed a couple of people to work on the ship for a while, so we went down thinking we'd work on the ship and then maybe travel to South America, and we basically got stuck working on the ship, delivering goods between St. Lucia, Barbados, St. Vincent, Martinique, all around that area for almost a year, and then when we came home, we traveled through Central America, took a few months to do that, and then came back up to Washington State, and after that, slowly moved up to Port Townsend.
So what was a ship like? I mean, there are all sorts of ships, from teeny tiny to humongous. What was this one?
Well, in the freighter world, it was teeny tiny. It was 120 feet, mm-hmm. and it was a Norwegian inter-island freighter. It had a car deck for cars to pull on and some bunk rooms upstairs for people to spend the night and a big hold below for other things that they would carry around up there. And this American fellow that we got to know bought the freighter from the Norwegian folks. It was in pristine, beautiful condition and sailed it or motored it to the West Indies across the ocean. It was not meant to be an ocean-going vessel. By the time I got to see it down there in the West Indies, it was a shadow of its former glory, shall we say. But we still carried all kinds of merchandise between the islands.
Did you live on it?
Yes, we lived on the ship.
How many people were on the ship?
There was just my husband, myself, and the couple that owned the ship that lived there. And then we'd get extra help when we'd load cargo and unload cargo.
Still, that's sort of romantic, you know.
Yeah, one would think, right? Things always sound different than reality.
Yeah,
but it was a fabulous adventure.
Due to the climate, you could sleep outside, I would imagine,
some of the time. Yeah, we slept on the decks quite a bit because the bunk rooms were small. And
A little bit run down, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
After that, you were starting to say you slowly made your way towards Port Townsend. Why? Did you know someone here? Is that how it evolved?
Yes, while we were in the West Indies, we had some contact with some friends, one in particular who was in a band with my husband and moved to Port Townsend. Two of the bandmates actually had moved to Port Townsend, which is a place that the band used to come to play at the old town tavern that was in town. But in him moving there, his parents had bought this piece of land he was living on, and there was an extra cabin there for rent, so he said, hey, if you guys don't want to go back to Carnation Duval area, why don't you just move to Port Townsend? We have a cabin for you. So that's what we ended up doing.
That's very handy. You know?
Yeah, that's right.
Like,
yeah.
Finding housing is a big issue.
It was a good place to come. That was in Chimicum.
All right. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. The show's called Our Town. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. Our Town profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work on the Olympic Peninsula. Today, my guest, Holly Mayshark, General Manager of Quimper Mercantile. She was just talking about some of her youthful adventures and then finally how she ended up here with a cabin in Chimicum as an enticement. What did you do when you first arrived in town? Did you have your kids by that point? Or
No kids yet.
Okay.
We started a construction business. That was one of the first things we did. And I worked with my husband. I had some carpentry experience and some design construction experience before I met Rick. And so we started Tall Shark Construction right around 77, 78. And that changed names at one point to Tallison Builders, but that was in business for about 35 years before my husband passed away.
And so what sort of construction were you doing?
All kinds, commercial and residential. They did a lot of custom work, high-end remodels. You know, we took almost anything in the beginning, but at one point the courthouse got remodeled by our construction company, the whole bottom floor, and I think the bell tower and the Presbyterian church was remodeled and added on to by them, as well as many houses in town that were either remodeled or built.
I've always wondered about the courthouse.
The interesting part of the first remodel they did there is the whole basement was the jail, the local jail.
I didn't know that.
So when they built the jail out in Hadlock, they wanted to take the jail apart that was in the basement of the courthouse and put Public Works Department down there. But it was apparently, as I remember, it was built originally as part of the original courthouse. So they built the whole perimeter and foundation of the courthouse and then lifted the jail cells basically down into that hollow and built it from there. So when they went to take the jail out, it was very old and sturdily built, shall we say. So they had to do a lot of cutting and work to get it apart. And there are lots of very interesting paintings and drawings behind those walls from turn of the century. From prisoners who'd been in there painting and drawing schooners and all kinds of interesting graffiti for the time period.
Was any of it saved?
No. I think it may be behind those walls still, but other than that, they took pictures of everything, maybe video too, I'm not sure. And I don't know if the museum has any of that information.
Interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I also heard at some point there was another level on top, you know, like another story or another tower.
That was City Hall. I'm not sure about the courthouse. City Hall had another.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Maybe I'm a little confused there. All right. So you were doing that and for 35 years. Along the way, you had two daughters, I would think.
Well, along the way, we have two kids, a son and a daughter. And also in the meantime, while the construction company was running, I started my flower shop in 81.
Okay.
So I pretty much veered off from the construction business, and Rick ran that, and I had babies and ran the flower shop.
So you stepped away from the construction company.
For every day, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I think most people in town know Holly's Flowers, know the name and see it. Mm-hmm. And you said, was it 81 you started it?
1981, yes.
And why did you decide to do that?
You know, it wasn't a straight line, Marianne. I was standing on the corner talking with a friend who had a little tiny shop downtown. His name is Wes Eng. He's still in town, I believe.
Yes, I know Wes.
And he had a little magazine store. And another mutual friend came up who used to have a flower shop in town. Lynette was her name. And she's talking to Wes about selling her old flower cooler that she now had stored in her garage. And he thought it would be a fine thing for people to come in and buy a magazine and grab a little bundle of flowers as they went out the door. And it was kind of before the time that grocery stores carried so many flowers. So basically, I was going to landscape architecture school in Seattle during the week and coming home weekends, and that was getting old, I have to say. So my ears kind of perked up, and we went over to a local brewery or drinking establishment or some sort of restaurant and sat down, and about 4 or 5 hours later, I had bought the cooler, and I was going to put a few bouquets in there to sell. One thing led to another. Next thing I knew, it was Mother's Day, and people were lining up out the door waiting for flowers for Mother's Day, and I didn't even have a clue it was going to be Mother's Day. So the straight line didn't work in my world too well, but I learned fast. Yes. And we grew from there. We have four locations before I ended up selling it, right, all within about a block of each other as I kept growing.
Really? Wow. When did you sell? What year were you in?
I think it was about 2006. Mm-hmm. Pretty sure.
Was there any clear reason, or is it just time for the next adventure?
It was kind of time for the next adventure, yeah.
Oh, that happens.
I love a lot of things about it, and some things I was ready for a change, and I worked really hard for a lot of years. The flower business is a beautiful, wonderful business, but it is hard work for not much compensation, that's for sure. The perishable part is always a bit stressful, yeah. And the holidays, they don't give you a month to do Valentine's Day. It's one day and you have to get it all done. So we'd be sleeping on the floor with all the leaves and cuttings to get a little nap before we carried on all-nighters.
That would be stressful. I would think so.
Yeah.
Ooh. Did you take a breather for a while, or did you jump right into something else?
I pretty much jumped into other things, yeah. I had several different jobs over a period of about 5 years before I was hired by the Mercantile.
I'll just quickly mention a couple of things you did.
I worked for a local architect. I worked for a landscape architect. I worked at the Leader for a year and a half. Probably a couple other things, doing accounting too.
So you joined Quimper Mercantile even right before they opened, right?
Correct, yes.
I think a lot of our listeners don't really know the story of the store and what it stands for and how it operates. Can you just describe the whole setup of a community-owned store?
Sure. It's kind of unusual. And big shout out to the board of directors that really did an amazing job. They worked with Washington Department of Finance and did a public offering, offered shares for sale, $100 a share, to buy into starting this little community store. There were lots of rules as far as how much they could raise and how long they could raise the money. So they sold 900 plus shareholders, and they raised $700,000 in order to get it started. That's pretty much how it worked in the beginning, but the board of directors really had a lot of work to do to talk people into this business that was just a hope and a prayer at that point.
It's a privately owned company, so you don't have to report your financials. You mentioned the other day that the store has been in the black for a while, but unlike other stores where the primary goal, let's face it, is to make money, that's not really the primary goal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, in order to stay alive, our absolute primary goal is to make money, but unlike a big corporation, it's not to make a lot of money. And the shareholders, their only part is to elect the board of directors. That's the only say that they have in the store, really, ultimately. The board of director, of course, oversees our direction and everything, but it is, like you say, it's a C corporation. It's a for-profit corporation, and so the 15 employees run the store on a day-to-day basis and take care of everything, the buying, and merchandising, and inventory control, all that. So yes, we need to make a profit in order to do what we do, but we're very open, try to do our best to be a good community citizen. We care about our town and our customers, fellow business owners. We're sensitive to being a good steward for our community.
Now, you didn't join as general manager. You had a lesser role for the first year or two.
Yeah, I was hired as the assistant manager.
Can you describe what your duties mainly are? Obviously, you manage the staff, but what else do you do?
I manage the staff, and I've done a lot of the buying for the store. However, I have recently hired a buyer who is helping, and there are other people who work at the store that buy certain products for certain departments that help out as well. I'm basically responsible for all of it, but I have some great staff working for me. I have a new assistant manager. I do a little bit of everything.
Let's talk about the buying a little bit. It sort of intrigues me that you go to shows, right?
Correct.
And you just wander around and point at something and say, I want 50 of those. How does it work?
Some of the shows are set up different than others, but many of them are like what people might think of if they went to a boat show or something. There's different booths with different vendors that sell different things. We already were buying from many different vendors when I was hired. So from there, we just look at how sales do with certain vendors, dropping them, bringing in new ones, listening to the community when they ask us for things as best we can. Someone was asking for smart wool apparel the other day because we carry smart wool socks. So I looked into it. I brought smart wool apparel in, and there's some happy customers now because it's a beautiful merchandise. We're open and try to pull in what people are asking for and do the best we can for a small store.
So if people ask for things, and certainly if a number of them ask for something, you're willing to explore it?
Certainly willing to explore it. I'm always open to it. And I'm open to people's opinions. What you had to say about the bed and bath department, Marianne, the other day, is all that information, the questions, compliments as well as criticism, whatever it is, I am open to hearing things, and we certainly can improve always and strive to improve.
Now, you were explaining to me something about the buying groups, the power of a buying group. Explain that.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing. So a buying group, in this case, the one we belong to, it's called Worldwide Distributors. They're out of Kent. It's a nonprofit, and they are an umbrella organization that will foot the bill or guarantee payment from vendors that normally we wouldn't be able to buy from without somebody signing on the dotted line and signing their life away, which we don't have. We have 900 shareholders. They're the owners. Normally, an owner will say, I will promise to pay this bill, but we don't have 900 signatures to say that. So we joined this buying group, and they have two big shows every year in Reno, and lots of vendors offer things at great prices. And a buying group that somebody might understand better is, for instance, in hardware stores, Ace Hardware is a buying group, or True Value is a buying group. Right. So it's power in numbers.
When I've been in there, I've noticed quite a few items that are clearly marked made in the USA. Is that a conscious decision?
We absolutely have a conscious decision to buy as much as we can made in the USA. However, in particular, the apparel business, it's very, very small percentage of companies that, even small companies that can afford to have things made in the U.S. We want to get things at reasonable prices. We'd love to get things made in the USA, but they're always way more expensive. Most of our socks are made in the U.S. We're happy about that. And occasionally some of just random other things, and a lot of local products too. I have at least 12 artists that make cards that we sell, a local soap maker, some candy makers and chocolatiers and all kinds of things that we continue to try and are open to that very much so.
I was particularly interested to hear that one of these American sock makers have lifetime guarantees for their socks.
Oh, our lovely Darn Tough socks are amazing. They're made in Vermont, and they do. They have a lifetime guarantee. So when people come in and say, I really don't want to spend that much money on a pair of socks, all I can say is, I understand the investment, but think of it as that's the same pair of socks you will have for the rest of your life. If you can make a hole in it, they will send you a new pair.
Wow. If you get a pair, it better be a color and everything that you really like, that you know you want to go with.
You could get a different color the next time you pass it in, most likely. But their return policy is, I think, 0.02%. So they don't get a lot.
That's amazing.
It's really a good sock.
So the store's been open since 2012. And you've noticed any trends in what things that don't work for the store and things that, you know, that you've moved away from because this department didn't work, but that department works so much better and we've expanded it?
Shoes and apparel are our strongest departments, and they do the best. Children's clothing or shoes is the most difficult, and we really want to offer it because we know that there are people that need those kind of things in town. But I understand as a mother that it's hard to afford things, and I'm always looking for well-priced things, but even when we get well-priced things, and it's hard to sell them. So that's been a struggle That's one department that they've been shrinking. Those departments have been shrinking because things just don't sell. I bring them in and then I have to put them all on sale to get them out of the store.
Mm, that's too bad. And what about the seasonality of the business? Are there peaks and valleys?
Absolutely. Like every downtown business will tell you, January, February, March, October, November, they're tough months to make it. There's definitely not as many sales. There's always things for us to do. We have shows and we start getting merchandise in, filling the store back up after the Christmas season, also after the summer seasons. Our busiest month of the year is December, and then our next busiest months are July and August, and then going into
September.
And
are you able to track in any way what the percentage local versus visitors?
The easiest way we can track is we have a wonderful system for our local rewards program. And by local, we wanted to give back to the people who set us up and started our store. So everyone who lives in Clallam, Jefferson, and Island County can sign up for our local rewards and they get a discount, 5% discount once they spend $100, and then they have that discount for life. So that's one way we're able to track, because if basically we look at our receipts at the end of the day, we can see all those people's names next to their sales. So it's a kind of a rough way to judge, but probably 75% of our sales, especially during every month, but July and August, are mostly locals.
That makes sense.
They have to have somewhere to buy their socks and underwear. That's what happened when Swain's went out of business.
Yes, that's true. Amazing. Well, I'm happy to hear that everything's going well there, because after Swain's went out of business, there were a lot of people around town who were sort of skeptical that someone could make it. And particularly when this concept came up, there were some people very enthusiastic, and let's say there were some people not so enthusiastic.
Absolutely. It's easy to see why people would be skeptical. So we're totally grateful. Could not have done it without these wonderful supporters.
Okay. Well, Holly, I hate to tell you this, but we're basically out of time. Did we miss anything important, do you think, that you'd like to say about Quimper Mercantile?
Thank you all for supporting us. We couldn't do it without you. We love your compliments. I'm happy to take your criticisms.
Okay. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today, Holly Mayshark, General Manager of Quimper Mercantile, the community-owned store in downtown Port Townsend. Thanks again for being on the show. I also want to thank my partner, John McPherson, the man in the glass booth, the editor and producer of Our Town. He's the one who smooths things out, takes out our stumbles and mumbles and you-knows, and makes me and my guests sound ever so intelligent and much more eloquent than we really are. I also want to thank three people who are deeply devoted to this station: Larry Stein, program director; Kate Ingram, station manager; and Robert Ambrose, chairman of the board. All work incredibly hard to make KPTC a strong local community radio station. I want to thank you, the listener. As a community radio station, we're all volunteers here. Everything here is donated. Consider donating money to the station, but consider volunteering. You could come down and help us out. We always need more volunteers. Our regular listeners know we're in the middle of renovating a building at Fort Warden, which will become our new headquarters. Construction's underway right now. We might move in come September. You know how it is with construction. It always takes longer than you think. But let's keep those donations coming in. So, listener, I'm signing off for today. But please keep listening to KPTZ Port Townsend, 91.9 FM, for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by John McPherson.